The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Determinant of a child's future is their parents' occupation, and the reality is that under capitalism, schools serve to maintain and enforce class divisions rather than to overcome them. For the vast majority of us, schools are segregated, overcrowded, and starved for resources. They stress accountability, obedience, standards, and basic skills, all qualities that really help to prepare the next generation of workers. If you think about just how much time is wasted in schools getting students to sit in chairs for 6 to 7 hours a day, which is fundamentally unnatural for any human being, and that's obviously to prepare you for a whole life, sitting in chairs or doing that kind of labor. A study by Jean Annion of fifth grade classes showed that working class schools emphasize discipline, obedience, involve no choice or negotiation, and students, when questioned, think of knowledge as something which they do not create. In fact, the words thinking or mind rarely come up in response to any question about what knowledge was. In contrast, the schools for the wealthy, students are taught to think critically, develop confidence in thought, leadership skills. These schools are characterized by a certain degree of choice, there is negotiation, and students are encouraged to see themselves as creators of knowledge and play an active role in learning, decision making, and ultimately they will become the next generation of bosses, politicians, and leaders. And if people have at some point, it's incredibly infuriating to go and actually check out the website of Sidwell Friends Academy, where the politicians send their kids, and compare that to the policies they implement in our schools. The myth of meritocracy means that when, however, our schools inevitably fail to overcome the class divisions or massive income inequality that lies at the heart of American society, we blame not the inequalities themselves, but teachers, students, and parents. If schools, in addition to maintaining class divisions, schools also reflect the dominant ideological biases of capitalism. They were competition instead of collaboration, individualism rather than collective learning and action, and the idea that humans are motivated by rewards and punishments, without which we'd have absolutely no reason to do anything at all, which means none of you should actually be here unless you thought I was going to give out stickers at the end, which I might. All the basic assumptions of education under capitalism distort learning. Education is standardized, sterilized, achievement on high-stakes tests, takes the place of meaningful learning, and by design, any kind of meaningful teaching. In this upside-down world, each subject is taught separately with a list of specific skills to be taught as unrelated exercises in futility. As such, each unit bears no relation to the one before, and knowledge is fragmented and abstract. Most fundamentally, learning or knowing is separated from doing or creating in a way that is intrinsically unnatural. As Linda Darling Hammond remarks, if we taught babies to talk as most skills are taught in schools, they would memorize lists of sounds in a predetermined order and practice them alone in a closet. Among both children and adults, radical pedagogy begins with a very different premise, that people learn best when learning is meaningful, providing them with a direct ability to use it for liberatory purposes. We learn best when we develop critical thinking skills through collaboration and collective discussion or action, rather than memorization of bits of random information. We learn best when we are empowered to make choices over what we learn and how we learn it. We begin with the basic idea that learning is actually natural, and that children have a natural curiosity to understand and explore their worlds. In fact, as Deborah Meyer says, a passion for learning isn't something you have to inspire kids with, it's something you have to keep from extinguishing. And the problem is, of course, our schools do extinguish it. If you look at a small child, a 2 to 3 year old, who is incredibly excited to learn new words, facts about their world and their role in it, and then you kind of see what happens by the time they enter my classroom, and you look at that, you know, the 7:40 a.m. class of senior English students who are looking at you like, I dare you to make me learn. You have to wonder what happens in between, and I think we have to say that what our schools do, that love of learning is rapidly annihilated with every number 2 pencil used to bubble in a circle on a meaningless test, with every recess canceled to make time for test prep, and by every piece of data which turns children into numbers in the name of accountability. As a result, for the vast majority of people who do not have the privilege of being born into the ruling class, education is profoundly alienating and serves to crush the real potential that humans have for creative, intellectual, and productive labor. And just, I don't want to spend too much time talking about the horrors of education under capitalism, because there's a whole other talk later on today on that. But I did want to just give one example. Mostly it's partly gratuitous, because it's just so infuriating, and I had to spend a whole day in professional development this week learning about this. Some partly people I'm sure are familiar with the new Common Core standards. And we were given a sample lesson to explain how, you know, there's a move, I'm an English teacher, away from fiction and things like that. We don't want to do that, just information texts. It's this focus on text-based literacy, which means you don't need the context of the text at all. So, for example, in a sample lesson on the Gettysburg Address, there's a list of questions that a teacher should not ask because they, quote, take the students' attention away from the text, which can be misleading and rob precious class time for students and teachers. The examples of erroneous guiding questions, with erroneous underlined, are Lincoln says that the nation is dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Why is equality an important value to promote? Next, why did the North fight the Civil War? Is irrelevant because he says they don't actually ever mention that. They don't mention North and South in Gettysburg Address. You don't need to know the context of the Civil War to understand the Gettysburg Address. This is David Coleman, who's the architect of this. He's my new favorite person to hate in education. And you have to wonder why anyone would say something completely ridiculous. And he explains it himself. So he says, it's because as you grow up in this world, you realize people really don't give a shit about what you feel or what you think. And in case you think that was, quote, was taken out of context, which, given his insistence on text-based questions, might be fair enough, I'm going to give you the context. And this was all, by the way, at a speech at the New York State Department of Education to explain the Common Core standards. He says, do people know that two most popular forms of writing in American high school today? It is personal writing. It is either the exposition of a personal opinion or the presentation of a personal matter. The only problem, forgive me for saying this so bluntly, the only problem with those two forms of writing is as you grow up in this world, you realize people really don't give a shit about what you feel or what you think. What they care about is can you make an argument with evidence that is verifiable? He continues the example. He says, it is rare in a working environment that someone says, Johnson, I need a market analysis by Friday, but before that I need a compelling account of your childhood. That is rare. He also, just to be clear, he also says that loving evidence within the text is perhaps more important than loving children, because that's what made all of us become teachers. You know, clearly these are qualifications which make him help to determine national policy, as well as to become the president of the College Board, which uses bubble tests to kill the love of literature and learning, whenever possible. It's easy to hate David Coleman, but I think it's also actually a fairly succinct and telling expression of the philosophy of education under capitalism. It makes it obvious, I mean, one, that this man knows absolutely nothing about pedagogy and has never spent a day in a classroom, which of course he hasn't. And in today's world, a complete lack of educational experience and pedagogical knowledge is a prerequisite to create educational policy in this country. But if you think about it, let's face it. Anyone who has ever spent any time in a classroom knows that if you walk into a room full of teenagers and say, look, your thoughts and feelings don't matter, no one cares, now let's discuss a text, it's a failing strategy. Totally dismiss the idea that teachers should in any way acknowledge students' life experiences or try to make connections between what we teach and what they live. But I think what's most disturbing about it is what the assumptions it makes about our students, which gets at the heart of education under capitalism. What he makes clear is that our students will never be the boss who can wax sentimentally about his childhood or say his opinions as much as he wants or express anything. No, the student he imagines in our schools will be subservient to someone else. Two, our students will never be in creative fields that are built on the kind of creative personal forms of self-expression that he so objects to. In this vision, none of our students will be writers, artists, filmmakers, comedians, actors. Beyond that, on the most basic level, the humanity of our students is completely dismissed. The idea that education serves not only to prepare people for skills that can be immediately translated into the workplace, but to allow people to explore who they are, their values, beliefs, and opinions, and to prepare all people to contribute to the society they live in, no matter their occupation, is laughable to him. What he makes clear is that he expects all of our students to work in a world where, on a basic level, their humanity does not exist. They exist to fulfill orders, to perform skills, not to express themselves, voice opinions, or in any way use their knowledge and education to shape their own life stories and world visions. That is for another class of students to learn. And this is obviously profoundly sad, and it's no wonder that an educational system, which begins with this premise, fails repeatedly. The reality is education has always been political, despite all attempts to sanitize it and isolate pedagogy and classroom practices from the world students live in. Capitalism needs workers to have a basic level of education, some form of basic literacy, for example, to perform certain jobs, and schools are meant to socialize students to fulfill those roles. And that's why you kind of see these dire predictions, like, you know, it's because of our failure as educators that the economy is going to tank. And again, another not a great way to motivate students to go and say, you need to learn this because the economy and national security needs it. But I think there's the other side of education, which is that it has a dangerous consequence too. It can be used to understand one's world, to learn from history, to communicate with others, to organize, and ultimately to fight back. And that's why you look at the history of education, I think, and people haven't read Education and Capitalism, the Brian Jones's chapter, among others, kind of goes through this history of people fighting for education. And you have to say there's a reason why it was, for example, illegal to teach slaves to read. There's a reason that Native Americans is a great part in the book about this, were forced into schools as part of an attempt to crush any resistance, and that, in fact, colonialism is kind of, you know, all colonial projects have pretty much used education in some way, hand in hand with brute force to subjugate peoples. And I think it's this contradictory nature of education under capitalism is in part what makes it so explosive and turns our schools into sites of struggle. Because the reality is that when the lie of education in our society, that as the means by which the playing field is supposed to be leveled, comes into conflict with the reality, which denies every aspect of this myth, there are explosions that get at the heart of capitalism. They exposes the utter lie of meritocracy and the idea that anyone can succeed with hard work and determination. When people find instead that they are systematically denied an equal education and are treated as second-class citizens, the entire logic of capitalism is exposed, and fights around education inevitably erupts. As radical educators, too, I think it's this kind of the contradictory aspect of education, and because many of us understand both the repressive role that education plays as well as its liberatory potential, that we become teachers. Despite the media blitz on bad teachers, most of us don't actually go into education because we want to kill the enthusiasm of our students or prevent them from learning. For many educators, teaching is a way to try to change the world, to inspire people and give them the tools that they need to shape their world and fight for social justice. And there's a very rich history of radical pedagogy that teachers can, and I think should, implement in their classrooms to the best of their ability. But there's also a reality that no matter how much we want to close our doors and try to create a space for social justice in our classrooms, we can't. There's always a charter school waiting to take our classroom space away. There's always budget cuts and those standardized tests which end up determining much of what we do. And I think this is why so many of the best teachers leave so quickly. They run up against the limits of the classroom itself, the myriad obstacles that are just too great, the innumerable indignities they face that are just too infuriating, and the human toll that the system takes on students and teachers is just far too devastating. As an individual in our classrooms, we're really at our least powerful, and it's for this reason that ultimately radicals, I think, need to be active beyond the classroom to fight for education reforms here and now, but also ultimately for a far saner and more humane world. And I think one of the reasons that teachers unions, for example, are so demonized is precisely because they provide one of the ways that we can organize that kind of resistance. The reality is that successful educational campaigns have always been inextricably linked with political attempts to understand the world and change it. It's not surprising, for example, that the three most successful literacy campaigns of the 20th century were Russia, Cuba, and Nicaragua, owing little to ideologies of competition, deregulation, or the free market. Rather, they were imbued with the revolutionary impulse from which they were born. It's the experience of struggle, the connection to social movements, and the radical and revolutionary climates in which it comes into being that provides the impetus and material conditions for the birth of radical pedagogy, which is a pedagogy that goes hand in hand with understanding the need for a radical restructuring of the world. As Paulo Freire says, pedagogy doesn't make revolution, striving for revolution shapes pedagogy. And I'm going to spend the rest of this talk kind of going through some examples of moments where we can, I think, learn some of these examples in context of how education becomes you know, imbued with a different kind of power in these moments of social movements. Just one example I start off with is people may have heard about the citizenship schools initiated by Miles Horton of the Highlander Folk School in Tennessee, which is a school where both Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King Jr. Participated in workshops prior to the Montgomery boycott. Obviously, the idea of literacy in Jim Crow South was inherently political, as it was used by segregationists to prevent African Americans from exercising their right to vote. In the mid-1950s, activists at the Highlander School decided to create literacy programs whose primary purpose was to help disenfranchised African Americans to get the right to vote. For many who came to these schools, formal education had proven to be a humiliating and alienating ordeal. In other unsuccessful literacy programs, adults were placed in classrooms where their grandchildren went to school and sat at children's desks where they were laughed at and called granddaddy longlegs. The new citizenship school's first job was therefore to find an educational setting outside of school and create a program whose basis, was first to respect people. The first school Horton helped organize held classes in a beauty parlor, therefore. They were taught by Bernice Robinson, who was a beautician with no formal teacher education, but who had been to some of these workshops and was very well respected in the community. She began her classes by reading from posters of the Universal Declarations of Human Rights. This became the students' introduction to literacy as they first discussed the meanings of rights, democracy, and citizenship. Later, she had the adults in the class tell her their life stories, which she wrote down as they narrated, and these texts became the text by which they learned how to read. Not surprisingly, this was far more successful than traditional schools with their small desks and Dick and Jane primers, and by the end of the class, more than 80% passed the examination. In other words, they were able to go down to the courthouse and register to vote. And I think this example and some of the others I'm going to look at are, there's a couple conclusions I think we can draw, which, in some ways they seem very common sense, which is probably why under capitalism they don't exist. One, that people learn best when words are charged with political meaning and relate to issues and struggles that they are actively engaged in for social justice. Two, the most successful pedagogy is one that involves active participation in collective and cooperative learning and emphasizes development of critical and political consciousness to understand the world, one's material conditions and social relations, and how to change them. Education is not an individual or a competitive process, but rather a collective one in which teacher and student learn from each other equally. And education does not exist in a vacuum. It is most empowering when it goes beyond words to become a tool for self-emancipation and for the radical restructuring of society as a whole. And I'm going to spend a little time particularly talking about May 68 in France, both as an incredible example, but also I think there's a lot of parallels with some issues that I think we're seeing now in terms of some of the Occupy movement. And it's a great example where you can really see students helping to take the lead in shaping a new educational system. The revolt of students in France in May 1968 led to occupied universities and lycées, which were the high schools, creating democratic committees with teachers and staff to run schools. It began with a small numbers of students at Nanterre, which is a university outside of Paris. And people were radicalized by the Algerian and Vietnam Wars and had begun to organize. And actually, at the very beginning, think about, I was at a Jen Rush's talk on spontaneity and organization this morning, which was excellent. The first kind of struggles were over very, minor issues. It was fight to, they wanted to get rid of a curfew in dorms to go visit co-ed dorms after 11. Yet the kind of repression they faced and the kind of larger political radicalization that was happening meant that when they faced immense repression from violence and violence from the police and the state, the student movement was quickly expanded well beyond Nanterre as students and workers joined forces to bring the state to its knees. A general strike was called for May 13, which galvanized workers and students to organize demonstrations, strikes, sit-ins, and occupations of factories and school. The Sorbonne, a historic university in Paris, was occupied and it became the cultural center of the student movement, but it was really the solidarity of the workers who occupied factories around the country that gave the movement its strength. A notice posted on May 13 gives some expression to the kind of revolutionary fervor of college students who rejected both the politics and pedagogy of the old university. It had a headline, 13 of May equals the return to school, and the leaflet satirically proclaimed the success of all students on their required examinations, which had been suspended because of the strike. And it congratulates all students for passing the tests of spirit of initiative, developing a political conscience, revolutionary discipline, solidarity, protests, and barricades. It continued by noting that classes were set to begin once more and invited all students to participate in a program of critical university, critique of society, student worker alliances, autonomy of the university. Many historical accounts of the student revolt in 1968 in Paris focused primarily on institutions of higher education, but the activism of high school students is often overlooked. There's some incredible material if you read the kind of leaflets and documents that they put out. I have a book that they put out of all these, kind of centralizing some of the documents of the student movement in high schools, and it's really amazing to see teenagers kind of take control of their schools in the way that they did. Like their counterparts, they had been radicalized by the wars in Algeria and Vietnam and angered by a rigid educational system that was hostile to student initiative and independent thought. One action committee put it this way: we need to end high schools that are snack bars of culture with a student as consumer who in solitude passively digests the food that is imposed on him. As one of the action committees on examinations, they created their commissions on examinations, explained, we are preoccupied with curricula. We cram, we bluff, and learn more for the sake of the exam than to form our personalities. We are judged on bookish knowledge, hastily stocked, and that one quickly forgets as soon as the exam is finished. The exam privileges competition, emulation for social success, and reinforces individualistic mental habits. Sounds familiar? When the CRS occupied the Sorbonne, high school students went on strike and organized what they called high school action committees, which the CAL is in their French acronym. They mobilized, democratized their school, and support the demands of the university students and workers throughout Paris. And over 10,000 high school students took to the streets as part of the general strike and joined their university counterparts. On May 19th, after teachers decided to strike again, students occupied the schools, embarking on an experiment in democratic education that has rarely been replicated. I'm going to give you one example from one document about what that day, that first day, looked like. They go a little after 8 a.m., the seniors went on strike. When the teachers showed up, they informed them of their action in an attempt to establish unity. The teachers were a bit surprised, so they went into their usual room and discussed it and quickly decided to enter into the movement. At around 8:15, one of their union delegates announced to the students that the teachers were joining them. They asked them whether they would prefer to start with a general meeting or by 2 hours of discussion between teachers and students in their classes to discuss problems caused by the crisis at the university. The students went with the second choice. Between 8:30 and 10, animated discussions were had in an amicable and relaxed climate. Teachers and students freely exchanged their points of view on teaching, its goals, its methods, its programs, and outcomes. As of mid-morning, some responsible students were chosen by their peers from the older classes to organize work and to take charge of the younger students and assure order with those who were watching them and were not on strike. The administration, for its part, tried to come to terms with the new situation that had been created. At 10 a.m., there was a general meeting in the gym. The teachers at this point decided that it would be wise to include the younger students from 6th to 8th grade in the General Assembly, because without that there would be 500 to 600 young students left on their own with too few supervisors, and they're afraid who would have been overwhelmed, and particularly because it was very rainy and cold, so they couldn't go outside. During this meeting, debates were directed by the older students and teachers as the younger students participated. The decision was made to elect one delegate of students per class, and it was also decided to inform parents about the movement in progress. A first tract was written, others followed, and were quickly distributed. At the same time, they learned that similar actions were happening all over Paris. And that just gets us to lunch on the first day. By 2, all elections of delegates had taken place, and they created an interior committee. Work continued in all the rooms between young people and teachers on the theme of education reform. Between 8:30 and 11:30 at night, delegates of students and teachers were joined by delegates of the parents' associations, who overall agreed with them. They came up with new rules and organization. And I think you also, it's interesting, you know, especially to the effects of working together of teachers and students. So for example, which gave students a whole new insight also into the lives and experiences of their teachers in a way that can only really happen in this kind of collective struggle. So they put out a leaflet after having talked to teachers, saying to students, we need to be conscious of the fact that 80 people work to improve our learning conditions, that much more than us, they suffer repression from the administration, threats to their licenses, categorical refusals of dialogue. We need to react against such deplorable work conditions. This is by the students. They also called for the election of principals by teachers, which would be interesting. There were obviously many skeptics, but the seriousness of the occupiers had a profound resonance on observers. One participant explains, they imagined that the lycéens would take advantage of the occasion to run wild and even damage places, but why should they damage their materials, smash up their classrooms, sabotage their own work? It's on this point that the lycée occupations run parallel to the factory occupations. In both cases, the work tools were respected because they felt so much more responsible on discovering that they could function by the activity of the rank and file alone, without the interference of administrative hierarchies or the bosses. The student committees and occupations transformed the repressive hierarchical structure of schools. By working with teachers, they transformed the relationship between student and teacher from one of unequal power to one of collaboration. This was reflected in one of the most practicalizing yet radical political demands of the movement, was to eradicate the raised platform upon which the teacher's desk was placed in most French classrooms. As one of the committees explained it was to render the role of the teacher more human and to get rid of the kind of hierarchical relationship. They also wrote, we also suggest that desks be arranged in the form of horseshoe, and in the same vein argued for the principle of a three-day week for teachers, quote, to give them time to work on enlivening their lessons. They took on every aspect of education under capitalism. They opposed testing calling it absurd and socially reactionary, as well as technically absurd since 80% of it is based on luck. They also noted that these exams, quote, favor competition, emulation for social success, and reinforces mental habits of individualism. Man is a wolf for other men. One school proclaimed, education must permit the total development of individuals and therefore is in opposition to all ideas of specialization and precocious selection. No specialized idiots. Humans should not stay as fossils confined to the limiting horizon of their jobs. They should have varied activities. Schools should not exist in solitary confinement, but be an interaction of equal groups that mutually help others to progress. Currently, manual labor is opposed to intellectual work. We need to bring about the union of both. They created school days in which mornings were devoted to cooperative learning, afternoons devoted to political discussion, art, sports. David Coleman would have hated them because they objected to the study of literature as reading isolated passages in textbooks, which is how it was taught at the time, in favor of whole works that they chose. Some schools instituted courses in film. Many demanded courses in sexual education. At the height of the struggle, all 60 Paris high schools were occupied by their pupils, 20 day and night, as well as numbers of technical working class schools and 400 schools outside of Paris. They participated en masse in the major strikes and demonstrations and were sadly not exempt from the repressive violence that met protesters. One high school student, Gilles Totin, who joined a June demonstration in solidarity with the Renault workers, the factory workers who were one of the most kind of radical elements of the strike, he was murdered by the police, and his death served as a chilling reminder of the brutality of the state. But it was also a stunning example of the bravery of students who fought for a world in which, you know, what they said was, you know, to be realistic was to demand the impossible. And I just want to read this description of the funeral of Gilles Totin by a longtime activist and revolutionary, because I think who was very struck by the moves, I think it captures a lot. He wrote, I got there and there was an instinctive and spontaneous discipline. There was an extraordinary silence. You could feel a tense anger, a feeling of revenge to be taken. And there were all those kids with roses in their hands. Gilles' parents had asked people not to bring funeral wreaths, so they had bought roses. And there was the extreme youth, so serious. The majority, we were between 5 and 7,000, were between 16 and 18. And then they were whistling the Internationale. And it's so beautiful when one whistles it softly like a clandestine chant. It leaves an impression. Finally, there was the cemetery, where there were no speeches, no superfluous words, nothing. Only a young factory worker who had come from the Renault factory outside of Paris who pronounced this phrase, "You have fallen, we will continue the fight." And the kids dispersed as they had come, spontaneously in the same communal discipline. So I watched them leave. I thought, this is the generation of May. And I think while the student movement fell short of many of its goals, it did win some lasting reforms at both the university and high school level. New universities were created, and universities were given greater autonomy, with students playing a leadership role. In addition to the teachers' platforms being removed, students won the right to smoke. They also won the right to elect peer representatives at councils that evaluated students. I actually grew up in high school, and even by the time I was there, you still had every year began with you electing your delegates who were your advocates in all meetings with teachers that you were not present at. And they won the right to criticize teachers in these councils and the right to discuss politics in the school and distribute political materials. And I think it gives you a sense of what the effect that this had in terms of transforming society. And I think there's Ralph Frey, the architect of the Cuban Literacy Campaign, says in words that I think would really resonate today, he says, ever since the student upheavals in Paris during May of 1968, hundreds of people have been traveling the world in an attempt to isolate the crisis of our pupils from the moral struggles of our time. It is a gross diversion. We deny that there is a crisis in the schools. It is not a crisis in the classroom. It is a crisis in the social order. And I think the reality is that today, too, the crisis is not in our schools. It is a crisis created by a society that is based on systematic inequality and occupation, and Occupy Wall Street really is a product of the same crisis that has brought back from history the idea that we need to occupy our public spaces and our schools to reclaim them for the 99%. I want to spend the last bit of time to talk a little bit, though, about even greater, these kind of systems are very inspiring, but also this, how do we also challenge a system that inevitably makes us fight these same battles over and over again? And I want to look at the Russian Revolution, because I think, you know, you see there's no greater school than a revolution. And in revolutionary periods, ideas matter as never before. Thus, from trenches of the U.S. Civil War to the Russian front to the battles of lines of El Salvador, there are innumerable stories of soldiers, for example, teaching each other to read newspapers in the midst of war and famine. And one of the most inspiring examples of this is, I think, the Russian Revolution. While it occurred in the midst of extreme scarcity in a country with at least 60% of the population illiterate, and it was defeated eventually by a counter-revolution, the early years, I think, give some great examples. In the immediate aftermath, to say, education was massively overhauled with a tenfold increase in the expenditure on popular education. Free and universal access to education was at least doubled within the first 2 years of the revolution. Co-education was immediately implemented as a means of combating sex discrimination, and for the first time, schools were created for students with learning and other disabilities. They faced staggering odds. To give one, I think in 1922, the total number of children orphaned was like 7 million or something. One historian describes the level of scarcity, saying that in 1920, the People's Commissariat for Education received the following six-month allotment: one pencil per 60 pupils, one pen per 22 pupils, and one notebook for every two pupils. And they even had to put out a memo on a brochure on how to get by without papers, pencils, or pens. Nonetheless, in spite of this, there was this huge thirst for knowledge as schools and universities opened up. Universal education was crucial not only to the education of a new generation of workers, but also to free women. So universal creches were created in preschools, despite the scarcity, where they instituted a pedagogy of what they called free upbringing, where the freedom in the classroom was part and parcel of the revolution's transformation of social life. I'm going to give one example of Elizabeth gave one example of what they called a work school in terms of how education was made relevant. I'm going to give another one just to give a sense of how their schools were organized. One person was visiting a school, and the given theme, he said, that day was the city of Moscow. The history lesson was based on past events in the life of the city. Some geographical ideas were imparted by taking the children to the Moscow River and showing them what are islands, shores, and peninsulas. Arithmetic had its turn when the children turned out in a body to measure the block nearest the school and make various calculations regarding its relation to the city as a whole. The excursion is often expressed as a service, as a first aid to the textbook in the schoolroom. So in this school, on one occasion, the children were taken to the roof of Moscow's highest skyscraper, a building of some 12 stories, in order to obtain a bird's eye view of the city. From time to time, they visited factories, museums, and historical monuments. And he says the purely scholastic method is anathema in Soviet pedagogy. Every effort is made to give the pupils some concrete and visible representation of the things which they are studying. Schools also set up committees with representatives from teachers so they could learn collective action in practice. And there's another observer who talks about one school for orphans and homeless children where the basic, basic needs such as food and clothing and hygiene had to be met before any real learning could begin. But as the writer describes, says those were famine conditions. Yet the children in this school, after she brought them a gift of chocolate, she says, just learning to speak to each other, because many of them spoke different languages, had their school council for self-government, which received a gift of chocolate I sent them, duly electing a representative to come and get it, and furnishing her with proper papers of authorization, and then they divided the chocolate fairly. A more skeptical writer describes visiting a school, he says, where this was in place. He said, I found the pupils at work in various classrooms, studying and writing out their problems in composition, algebra, and elemental chemistry. Sometimes the teacher was in the room, sometimes not, but the students were left almost entirely to their own resources. The teacher seemed to function largely in an advisory capacity, giving help only when asked. If the students preferred talk or games to study, the teacher usually overlooked it. Each student was free to choose the subject or subjects on which they would work on any particular day. And this writer was concerned. He questioned Lunacharsky, the Commissar for Education, about whether such a model provided sufficient education and basic skills, such as grammar and spelling. And Lunacharsky replied, frankly, we don't attach so much importance to the formal school discipline of reading and writing and spelling as to the development of the child's mind and personality. Once a pupil begins to think for himself, he will master such tools of formal knowledge as he may need. And if he doesn't learn to think for himself, no amount of correctly added sums or correctly spelled words will do him much good. But he also explained it was hard to provide hard data on the success of the program as marks were unreliable and had been abolished, and so had tests been abolished, and Russia had no grading system. They got rid of tests to get into universities, opening them up freely to any worker who wanted to participate, because they said, common sense. It was believed that no one would willingly listen to lectures that were of no use to him. People should, if you weren't at Jeremy's talk on Vygotsky, I really recommend that people also listen to that. When it's supposed to be, it gives another sense of kind of the incredible creativity that occurred because of the revolution. Stalin's triumph spelled the end of the experimentation of the early years, and you quickly see a rollback. By 1931, an official decree mandated a return to the previous types of lessons and the lecture method in universities. Exams were reintroduced as well as grades, and curricula became fixed centrally instead of allowing students to determine their own course of study, and you see gradually how the promise of those early years was turned back. Nonetheless, I think it gives an incredibly important example of the possibilities for creative and radical reform that could be unleashed amidst even the worst conditions because of the revolutionary transformation of society at large. And I'm not going to go through some of its successes. The adult literacy campaign reached over 5 million people. In unions, literacy programs were very successful. Among the army, they at one point even had 100% literacy, despite the fact that they began with less than 50% literacy. But I think it's more important is the kind of stories of the innovation and radically restructured ideas of schooling and teaching as students at all levels take control of their learning, imbued with a thirst of knowledge in a world which was theirs to create and run in their own interest. I think the complete transformation of education and literacy in these examples exposes the lies that are at the heart of American education, that competition drives innovation, that punishments and rewards are the only motivations, and that schools are the great levelers. In fact, genuine learning triumphs in revolutionary situations that provide people with real opportunities for collective and cooperative inquiry and research. Literacy is always political. Radical pedagogy is at its most successful when it actively engages people in the transformation of their own words. And you compare that to the rote memorization, disconnected bits of information, bubble tests, and scripted-based curricula that suck out the learning, the love of learning in our society, and I think you get a real sense of what's possible. I think radical educators should draw on these lessons wherever possible to fight for an educational system that is liberatory rather than stultifying and sees our students as thinkers and actors rather than empty containers to be filled. But for most teachers, I think the opportunities to implement the lessons of these struggles are extremely limited as, you know, and even when they use some of their ideas, actually, they say things. So, like, I know we talked about this in the Vygotsky, you know, they'll use terms of Vygotsky that are about a very, you know, liberatory form of education, but then it's how do you use that to pass a standardized test, which is anathema to it. Or cooperative learning is implemented, and then you have, people may know Charlotte Danielson, where you have a rubric, and it's like if you don't have this many minutes in group work in your classroom, somehow that's the problem. So it's completely distorted. I participated once in a literacy program called Project Freire, based supposedly on Paulo Freire's ideas, except for that they took out the political part, which is kind of missing the whole point. And so I think it's no coincidence that these examples of radical pedagogy come from revolutionary periods of struggle, and that any kind of, I think, fight for education has to go hand in hand with the self-emancipation of working people and a fight for transformation of society overall. Under capitalism, education will always be a mean of maintaining class divisions rather than eradicating them. And I think to imagine an educational system that is truly liberatory, we need to talk about fighting for a different kind of society. A society in which, as Marx described, the free association of each is the precondition to the free association of all. It's only if we can eradicate poverty, prisons, oppression, and exploitation in all its forms that we can really unleash the human potential and creativity. And this is why we need to fight, right, for a world in which David Coleman has never allowed near a child, in which education and learning is meaningful for both students and teachers, and in which learning doesn't end at the age of 18 or 22, a world in which we can proudly say that what you feel and think not only matters, but your ability to express these thoughts and feelings will influence others and shape the very structure of our society. And I think if you start imagining a society where teachers and students democratically decided what learning should look like, and where learning was freed from the confines of a classroom. If we could use all that time wasted on getting students to sit in chairs or passing through metal detectors to learn, you can kind of get a sense of what would be possible and imagine really what a true lifelong learning could look like in a world where we were free to develop our own courses of study and unlock the creative potential of humanity. And I think the fight for that world is what this conference is all about and has to be one of the most important things that we as educators do. The fight for social justice inside the classroom has to go hand in hand with the fight for social justice outside of the classroom. And I would argue that this is the most important struggle educators can be in. If we can learn anything, I think, from this conference, it's not only that this fight has never been more urgent and more necessary, but also that we can win it.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.